That's Gene Harris on piano and the Scott Hamilton Quintet. Scott Hamilton, of course, on tenor sax with Blues for Gene. It's from their 1990 album, At Last, with Herb Ellis on guitar, Ray Brown, the great Ray Brown, on bass, and Harold Jones on drums. Gene Harris was born in Benton Harbor, Michigan, and was known for his deft combination of jazz, soul, and other gospel intonations. He combined them so beautifully. He died on January the 16th in the year 2000. He was 67 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we continue with yesterday's discussion about developing alternatives to the political so-called inevitabilities that we face in this presidential year. The inevitabilities, we're told, of course, they tell us already who the choices are going to be, who we will have to choose from, but we will, as a nation, one way or the other, come November, we will be selecting somebody who is going to sit at the head of the table at the White House and who will have the power and authority to rule as the commander-in-chief, as the president of the United States. But we look also at the polls, although we may not be a great believer in polls, I'm not. But they still are interesting in that they do give an indication of where people's heads are at. And people are saying the same thing. All these many months down the road, they're saying the people who are emerging as the standard bearers, both on the Republican and Democratic sides, we don't like them. We don't trust them. We don't like them. We don't respect them. And we don't want them. But they nonetheless are leading. This is the great anomaly that we face. And the bumper crop of choices, now having been whittled down to essentially three, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton on one end, and Donald Trump, period, on the other end, because this is, of course, the duopoly taking care of its business. The Republican and Democratic parties, assuming that there's nothing else that we can do, no other choice to be made. And we started talking yesterday about the fact that it doesn't look very much that we are going to see an independent parallel track being made here to do something with the supposed movement that began or is said to have begun under the aegis of Bernie Sanders. You see, from a political and strategic point of view, it makes sense that you have something independent of any established structure, because you can't trust the established structures. They have ceased to be useful. They've ceased to be in tune with what people need and what they want. They are very, very, as we can see, as we've been discussing, exceedingly anti-democratic. They do not respect the whole idea of government by the people, for the people. This is government isolated from and insulated against the people. Government, in effect, despite the people, and in an extreme form, government to spite the people. So the reality should tell us that there must be something else that we have to do, and we have to construct other ways of dealing with things. What are those other ways? And this is where our conversation returns to today. We are used to one model, let's face it. The one model, again, is a duopoly. You're either Democrat or Republican, and that's that. And you take, you know, successive turns at this business of electing people to office. And then comes the aftermath in which you start fighting with them because you realize that all of the things that they promised, all of the things they said they would do, the deep ties they said they have to you, the fact is they are loyal first to the system that elects them, and that's the political system, the party structures. They're loyal to that first. We get that. Is it not time that we change the model of behavior where we continue to do the same thing, although we know beforehand how things are likely to turn out? In other words, we understand the inevitability of things. We can see it unfolding before our eyes, and we have reason, based on statistics, we have reason to believe that things will remain remarkably the same. There's not going to be too much of a great difference here. So this, despite the fact that a very welcome dimension to this election cycle is if we have something, one would say, an unconventionality. We have that in a brash, crass, tacky personality of Donald Trump, who nonetheless also brings a refreshing frankness about the corruption of the Republican Party, and an unapologetic attitude about his right as a wealthy person also to rule the world and the planet, the rule everybody in it, so that he can boast of having achieved something that none of his ilk so far has. He would be able to say, not only am I exceedingly wealthy, hugely wealthy, but I've got what few of them have. I have an Air Force and an army. I have nuclear power. I have the power to press buttons to start wars. I could obliterate countries. I can do anything I want to do. I can make up a whole bunch of rules as I see fit. And he already has. He has changed the game. He has changed the rules. And this is going to be, and has been for the past several months, a source of great worry for the Republican Party. But let them deal with that. This is their thing. This is their world. This is their politics. The Democrats, on the other hand, are dealing with another kind of conundrum. We have the refreshing entry, at least one would have thought so, of Bernie Sanders, who says he is a democratic socialist, committed to entirely different ideological ideals. And he has a view of the role of government that is different so far, he says, from what the party itself largely holds to. And he's trying to flex the muscles that he's been given by the support of the people who are behind him in this movement, where he differentiates himself from the opponent, Hillary Clinton, on the basis of class and in some cases race, sometimes, I should say, on race, but mostly he has class differences, and he has some other kinds of ideological differences, but not so deep, not so unassailable that he decides to leave the party and mount a national campaign outside of the party. So he's within the party confines. He has pledged his troth to Hillary Clinton, quote, should he not be the party nominee, unquote. And even though he says he will be fighting for the very last vote up until then, he nonetheless has already made it clear that it is not his desire in any way to challenge the party in a fundamental way, to move outside of its confines. He wants to remain directly within it. So he has made it very clear, especially in recent weeks, that that's what he intends to do. Those 9 million votes that I've been talking about will more than likely end up within the Democratic Party structure and are likely not to be moved into galvanizing a whole political movement outside of the Democratic Party. So in other words, he's not really in for a major fight with the Democratic Party. He just wants to tweak it, perhaps, and to encourage it to be a little bit more panoramic in its view and include a couple of planks in its party platform that would show that the party is progressing, the party is more in tune with the electorate, and that the party basically can be looked to with some degree of trust by the people as a party sensitive to the needs of the people. All this stuff to me is hogwash. You know, the song says, is you is or is you ain't my baby? That's the question. Are you with the party or you're not? If you're with the party, then that's it. Let's be clear about that. You're with the party. I'm not. I'm not interested in the party. So for people like me, people like you, we talk about the duopoly all the time. What is, therefore, the task now? How do we reorganize not only our thinking but our action? And how do we reorganize our whole approach to this thing called politics? What is it supposed to do? What is it supposed to be? I also maintain that in this regard, we, this progressive community, for lack of a better term, has fallen down on the job. We punked out big time. We are actually unwilling or unable or just plain terrified about flexing our muscle and building, doing the work of creating community and organizing. So we pick up that conversation again today. How do we begin the process of reorganizing our thinking? And it doesn't have to be anything extravagant and anything, you know, monumental and worthy of news coverage. In fact, the kind of organization that we're talking about, the mobilization we're talking about, is very grungy work, very unattractive work, very tedious. And sometimes, more often than not, it's very lonely, because you may find yourself very much alone most of the time in these endeavors, or with the same two or three other willing souls. But we cannot look at that as a reflection of the value of what we hope to achieve. See? We have to have an entirely different approach. It calls for, the times are telling us. I mean, you've been observing the political landscape for these past several months, and it is, I called it a kakistocracy. No matter who wins, it will be governed by the people least qualified, the worst possible elements of our society will be in charge. What do you do? What is the response? What is a workable, smart response to this inevitability. That is the inevitability that we have to deal with. No matter who wins, we lose. That's the point. And we should have seen this coming. We have ignored all of the signs that we are the ones who need to get the change moving. We are the ones. Instead, we find ourselves as a progressive community, as an anti-establishment community, looking to the establishment to correct the errors of its ways, which just tells us we've lost our minds. And we look at the communities that are most distressed, that are also least protected. There's very little defense available to them. The lines of defense either are non-existent or are so blurred as to render them basically, you know, irrelevant. Their leadership is co-opted and corrupt. People who used, at least had a sense that their role as so-called leaders was to lead. But they think leadership is a kind of a prize possession that is up for grabs, that leadership itself has changed in meaning and in purpose, that you create yourself as a leader. The way Donald Trump says, you know, I'm sick of this thing. I'm going to be the leader. And I'll make up the rules. I don't have to deal with constitutions and other things that are very much in my way. I can make up the rules. I'm rich. I'm wealthy. You know, Bloomberg, Michael Bloomberg, proved that a long time ago. I can now tell you how much sugar I think you ought to have for the day. I can legislate that. Soon I'll tell you by what time you ought to be home and in your bed. You see, this is where we are. We have incredible mediocrity. We have people who are least qualified to govern, in fact, governing. We have money at the root of it all. Wealth on the side, whether it's Clinton or it's Trump, it's simply a matter of just, you know, a cosmetic difference. But it's essentially the same attitude. I've got it, therefore I'll take it. I got the money, I'll take the power. I just need you silly people, you unimportant people, just to come to your senses and give me what it is I demand. Yeah, I have to go through the rigmarole of running around shaking hands and pretending that I'm happy to be in your midst and all of that stuff. I got to do that. But essentially, this is what I want. I want the power and authority to rule and dominate. That's what I want. Anybody mistaking Hillary Clinton as a Democrat, meaning both as with a capital D and a small d, needs to have his or her head examined. The woman is a despot, as is Donald Trump. There's very little difference going on here. Okay, so we come back to the discussion, 7 8 8. Sorry. 888. 874-4888. My head is clogged up, but not with the right numbers, apparently. 888-874-4888. Let's get to this discussion about evaluating the moment that we're in as politically conscious people. Not just to point out what the problems are, you know, they're quite evident. But what is this moment calling us to do? And what do you suggest is a way to devise a different kind of approach, a different model of approach, where the power that we have, both individually and collectively, can be harnessed? But it has to first be organized somehow. How do we go about this? And how do we inculcate in our communities an entirely different view of things, where people can see the possibility of their power having both value and potentially great effect. We have to deal with this question of voting. Is voting even worth discussing? How do we engage people about this process of voting? What is it getting you? What is this charade that we are experiencing? Are we still talking about the power of the vote? What has to be done to arrest the moment, pregnant as it is, with all kinds of potential to get our heads cleared and to get our vision quite focused on the truth that we are experiencing? You don't have to wait to have CNN tell us about the great moments that's, you know, we're experiencing, and this year being such a historic election year. All of that is claptrap. The fact is, if we're talking about what we are experiencing versus what we are told about this process, there's only one conclusion. They're not matching. And they haven't been matching for a long time. What is the solution? Do we continue? Do we try to fix something? What would that something be, and how would you fix it? But most importantly, how are you fixing your own heads about this process? And what clarity are you getting out of the moment that we are experiencing? What is beginning to be crystal clear to you about this process? And how does that in turn inform your current and future action, your political consciousness? Are you growing as a result of examining these things that are just not matching up? How do you feel as a political entity yourself? This is, I think, where we ought to start the conversation today. We were to be joined today from Detroit by a group of activists. They are engaged literally as we speak in struggle. We will be rescheduling them for Thursday. They have much to tell us about their own experience and going through the rigors of lining up the reality they were living versus the garbage that was being shoved at them. But they are fighting back. And we look to Detroit not only just as a template of what is coming all over the United States of America, and Michigan as a state, as a template of what's going to happen in many states. But we also could look to Detroit for templates of how people are choosing to fight. And they're choosing to fight because they are choosing also to alter their consciousness about what's important and what's worth fighting for, and how to harness the power that they actually do have. So it's a great story. It is frustrating, of course, because it is loaded with so much sacrifice and the usual stories that we have been hearing all these centuries of targeted oppression. But you do have people who are fighting, and we have much to teach each other if we take the time to listen. So the first layer of conversation which I'm asking us to engage in today is this business of our collective consciousness. What are we learning from this process this year? And move beyond the silly circus nature of the thing. You know, we get that. This is silliness. But it nonetheless is instructing us about the nature of the struggle that we have on hand with ourselves, within our community, How are you interpreting the reality of this moment? What is it instructing you about your role, wherever you are, your role as a politically conscious person? What are you learning? How are you applying the lessons that you are learning from this experience that you are going through right now? And to what benefit do you see that you can contribute to help us get out of this morass? Because it's coming. We are being targeted, whether we wish to acknowledge it or not. They have even scripted our parts. We just show up when the script says show up, and we get to disappear when the script tells us to disappear. So that's the discussion. 888-874-4888. We are talking about politics and political science in a very humanistic way today, because it is about your own political consciousness and transformation. And hopefully that will give us a leg up on the various levels of discussion that we need to have about how people begin to organize, what informs political action and activism. Okay, that's where we are. Your thoughts at 888-874-4888. We'll take this short break and come back to that discussion right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're beginning to talk about political science in a very unusual way, because we are all political scientists. We have to analyze the moment and the times that we're in, and we're looking to get a fix, some kind of a set of pointers, depending on where you are in the scheme of things, as to where we can locate ourselves. And how do we fashion something of a defense against the onslaught that is to come? It will come. There's no question about it. That's part of the inevitability of things. We are in a time of inevitabilities. Whoever wins, it's inevitable that we will lose, no matter who wins. The process, it is inevitable that it will be working against us, not for us and not with us. So it is inevitable, it seems, that we have to construct something as a kind of line of defense. But we seem to be quite fragmented. We seem to be lazy about the business of organizing. We seem to be leaderless. Not that you need leaders, but you know, things do function well when you have somebody to spark the fire. And we seem to have lost faith even in our capacity to create change. So this might be a very good moment, coming out of a pretty challenging situation, to begin to fashion something of a suitable response, because it's going to get really bad real soon. And will that leave us always in a position of reacting, or would we, for at some point, will we be able to say, no, these are the things that matter? And how do you prioritize? How do you galvanize support? How do you build community at a time when the other sides are so effective at creating dissension, at breaking people up, pitting them against each other, playing one against each other, playing with our resources, playing with our rights? What is the best way to go? Let's start with Ali from New York. Hello, Ali. You're on the air.
Hi, Idris. How are you doing?
I'm hanging in. How are you?
Yeah, all of us are doing the same thing, hanging in. Okay. But I just wanted to bring this up and it's together with what you're talking about and what is our political consciousness of what is going on right now. And you know that when you organize, you know that the government comes very hard on you. And we know that. And this is something that I have been thinking about for what you're talking about, how to organize. As you know, I belong to different groups. And the reason that I had to bring this up is because this is what the government, this government do to you when you organize and you try to fight the system. Last night I went to a meeting, and this young man, his name is Jamel, he participated in something that we did for 3 days here in the city called Rise Up October, and it was called by an organization called Stop Mass Incarceration. And the reason that I had to bring this up is because to put it together, what are you talking about, how the government comes down on people. Right now, this the last day, it was October 24, and we were at Bryant Park at 42nd Street. When it was over, a lot of young people decided to walk to 42nd and Broadway and 7th Avenue. Over there, they have two statues, and the two statues, they have some what you call benches around the statue. No one in the city knows that if you go out on top of, you climb on top of those benches, I don't know what you call it, but you could get arrested. And just for climbing on the benches, it's like you're climbing on those statues. Five people got arrested. Three took ACDs. And ACDs, as you know, is when you take a deal, but you don't take any guilt. One person took a guilt because it was a young man and he didn't know, when they brought him in, he didn't know what to do, and he took a guilt. But this young man, Jamel, which tomorrow we're going to go to court because he had been doing a lot of civil disobedience and he had been arrested a few times. The police department took the case from the DA and they're using their own lawyer, the police department lawyer, to persecute this young man. Tomorrow we're going to go to 54th Street, is 314 West, 54th Street. Anyone who listening to this, come and support this young guy, because this is what the government, you're talking about organizing, this is what people are doing in this city, organizing. And since especially with Occupy Wall Street, since that moment, now this government doesn't want people to go out. It's like stopping you from protesting. And even when people, they were protesting against Donald Trump, the police came hard on people. So you're talking about our political consciousness. If we, all of us, we don't get together and do something together as a community, black, white, yellow, because they separate us. Right now, this is the way that they wanted to come on you. What I'm going to do, like I said, I went and I voted for the primary. Just it was a vote against this woman, which I can't stand, this woman, Hillary. But I will have to say, there is nothing to go out there for any of us. There's three people in my household to go and vote for any of these two people. Because it has been the government who has picked these people, picked them, for us to go out on there and give them the social vote. And look what happened in Brooklyn. 120,000 people could not vote. And that is Brooklyn. I know people, my son, not two of his friends, they couldn't vote in Queens. So this is what is going on. What can we do? Don't go out and vote. And I wouldn't even vote for the Green Party, because I can't vote for a party who telling me, I know I'm not going to win. If you know that you're not going to win, what are you doing out there? But I'm asking, please, people, come 314 West 54th Street at 9 o'clock. We're going to be out there. We go into the court because it's too small, but we wanted to support this young man, Jamel. Thank you very much.
Thanks for getting us started today. Let's go to Delaware and talk with Veronica. Veronica, what are your thoughts?
Good day. My thoughts were, I'm a UAM fan of yours, and I
thank you.
My thoughts go along the lines of New Orleans schools. I'm thinking of every spectrum, whether it's politics, religion, we are economically at the bottom. You put out exactly what I had been writing that on Facebook, that at the end of the day, this chess game, the libraries, the churches, every echelon that we have been successful, whether it Stokely Carmichael and the different things that were achieved, Kwame Ture. Now they want to make it that all those things that we did, they're closing down churches, they're closing down libraries. My daughter graduated college. Biden comes to speak at Delaware State University. I'm looking at Howard, the president, Barack Obama, speaks at the graduation. They never spoke at these graduations. I'm also looking at even Negevus College. They take down Dr. Clark's picture. They take down Dr. Ben's picture. All of the things that, you know, visually, images, the attack on Bill Cosby. It is, you do not need to see anything positive about you in the media, in the newspaper. We don't need anything consistent and so forth. I look at it as if we do not go back to basic Garveyism, and our own newspapers, our own, and support certain things, we are losing a battle. I am looking at Harvard taking Nasir Jones, you know, the rappers, the hip-hop conscious people, and employing them. Then you go over to the library in Harlem,
Schomburg.
Across from the Schomburg Library, where Dr. Clark marched and so forth. Now the image is there. I'm looking, they have now employed the curator. Harvard has employed him. Harvard graduate, the assistant dean at Negevus College. So I'm looking at the chess game that's being played, and we are so far behind. I'm looking at the things that are being done. So you're graduating with a degree from these colleges now, and you're getting less income, you're getting more work, you're being told, you know, don't even ask for promotion, but you're getting fired. You're doing twice as much work, and you're not getting an increase in pay. That's how they're getting rid of all the staff at Negevus College and so forth. These are the things that are going on, and you cannot teach any African-American studies if you're African-American. So I think all these scholars need to apply for Jewish studies and become the professors there. You know, I
so
am
Veronica,
seeing so...
What is this, but what is this adding up to, in your view? What is happening?
That is definitely military science. For you to be able to destroy images before you, and you're not looking at the entire thing. You're, as you said, they are telling you what to think and when to think. And if you can't think outside the box, you're not seeing some of the things I just laid out. I'm looking at even when, the sister before me said the deals that are being cut, jail, prison. How long does it take to get the wrongfully arrested, imprisoned, to get an officer into court? 6, 10 years, if it's not in the news, and then they don't even serve time? How is it someone like Peter Liang's case can go to court so quickly, and then he doesn't even get, he gets $800 community service. Then I look at the chokehold officer with his six help assistants, the gang in blue in Staten Island, and he's patrolling the same area where he choked this person. So it's okay. It's okay. You know, this is
all right,
a total...
But again, you're clear about certain things. Let me put it this way. You seem to be clear about the last.
Right. Do we write in reparations, retribution, 2016? Do we write these things in? Would that be our Adam Clayton Powell? This is what I believe we can do. We're not voting for these people. They get money by the amount of people that vote for them. We need to write in what we want, our demands. We don't need to wait on a Bernie Sanders. We need to write these things in.
Well, thank you so much for your contribution today and for getting us focused. Thank you so much for your contribution, Veronica. Let's go to Phil from Maryland. Phil, what are your thoughts?
Hello?
Yes.
Hello? Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay,
is this Phil?
I'm Marie. I'm Marie.
Okay, Marie.
I'm going to tell you, I was over in Nigeria in 2011. I was staying in a hotel there, and next across the street from the hotel were these tourist little stores, you know, they have for tourists. And one store, I was talking to the storekeeper. He asked, is Obama going to be doing anything better, or will he do something better? And I said, don't count on Obama to help you all out. This was 2011. And you see the way things are now. I'm not voting for either party. And I come from a family that does vote. But I'm not voting for this because it just means more confusion and sorrow on my part. Thank you so much for letting me talk. Bye-bye.
But Marie, before you go, because I suspect there's a lot that we could learn from you.
Oh,
have you felt like this before, or is this something that has just come upon you this political season more than at any other time?
I think this has come around this time really strong, but however, I have to correct myself. I haven't been voting for these presidents for a few years because they only represent the government and corporate interests of this country. They're not interested in low-income people or homeless people. So I don't feel bad, Lee, if I don't vote for him. In fact, I didn't vote for Obama in his first two terms, and I didn't feel bad about it. I didn't brag about it, and because I figured he would be doing something not good for the people anyway. I already figured that out. If the presidents are going to be backed by corporations, they're not thinking anything about the public. And I can't say anything else other than I agree with you. We're going to have trouble down the road. I don't know
What's a good line of defense to begin to take? What do you suggest is a good place to start?
I would say, and you check me out on this, I could be wrong. I would say if the public wouldn't vote for any of them. That's nonviolent. What do you think?
But I don't think they care. As long as somebody, if three people vote, they want to be able to win with the three votes. That's all they care about. They don't care about how bad it looks. You know, that people really didn't turn out as much as they ought to. That's not the least of their problems. Their thing is they want the power. They want it now. They want it because mm-hmm. they think they ought to have it. Mm-hmm. And by every means necessary, they'll get it. So, do you get a sense that the community has, in effect, a strong belief, or is it waning? Is it disappearing, this belief that they've got a champion?
Well, the few people I can talk with on this subject, it's not too many, in my opinion, Americans I can talk about politics in general. But the few I've spoken to, they feel the same way I do. They don't care to vote for any of them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They just don't care. And also they feel that violence is going to be coming down the road soon. And what happened in Baltimore last year is going to be more of them in larger cities or smaller cities.
Well, thank you for making your contribution today, Marie.
And
so grateful that you called.
Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. From Washington, D.C., Free, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm quite excellent. It's a wonderful day to be alive.
Yes, it is.
You know, you asked, I think, what have I learned? I haven't really learned anything other than how naive people can be, how powerful the disinformation and misinformation machine called mass media is, and how little discourse we have in our communities that can help, so we can help one another to become more enlightened, like what your show does. We need more of these things in our community. Because when it comes time to think about what we can do, we'll have more options than, you know, some of the ones that we've been coming up with. Because there really is a lot of opportunity here when you have both legs of the wobbly system revealed to be arthritic, filled with cancers and cankers and ready to fall at any moment. This is an opportunity for us. We have to be more creative.
Do you sense that this particular election cycle has been more pronounced in this regard than any other time that you could remember?
In the regard of it being exposed to be a total fraud?
Yes.
Yes, yes. And this is the time, these are the moments that you pray for so everyone can see the emperor has been naked. So you got, you know, open fascism with Trump, and then you've got Hillary Clinton, who has a proven record as a war criminal. Bernie Sanders is just kind of out there just trying to draw people off. You know, they're always trying to pick out who has a propensity to move towards change and then do something to deny them so that they lose interest in being involved. That's what we're seeing. That's going to be the Obama effect. When folks really start analyzing the policies and things that he did and they start rolling in some years down, and even now people are saying they're not going to vote and stuff because they've already been let down enough times. Which is not a new lesson to me. But now, if you're not going to vote, what do you do with that energy?
Well, what is your sense on a community level, what is your sense about the attitudes? I mean, you are quite clear, it seems to me, about the lay of the land. You've gotten some lessons that you tell us that you've learned in this particular year. How representative are you, you think, of the community in which you live? Or are you finding that you're a pretty lonely guy?
You, Trace, I'm glad you asked that. I live in Washington, D.C., what they call the capital of the free world. And in the two wards that I frequent the most, wards 7 and 8, that's how they divide the city up here, the literacy rate is 50%. So the battle for us is basic skills and comprehension, so then we can build a political will and a movement on the ground. As long as we have 50% literacy in a city that has a median income of $110,000, we're definitely in a bad state of affairs, politically, socially, in every way we can line it up. Other than our spirit, which shows us how powerful we are, that it remains unbroken despite all that.
So, in your evolution, in your recent evolution, your continuing evolution as a politically conscious person, where are you now?
I'm focusing on the issue of literacy in my community. We're having an event on May 21st on Malcolm X's weekend. You know, he was born on May 19th, to increase the literacy in our community. It's called Literacy is Love. It's really, you know, each one teach one and spread the light, you know. And also I'm focusing on my identity as a global citizen, not aligned to these states. If the corporations can be global and they're considered individual people as well, then I too must be global and look at how we can internationalize our lifestyles and our progression.
And interestingly, in that regard, Washington, D.C. is an excellent place to start because you do have a global community right there.
Yes. Yes, no doubt about it, and I give thanks to my ancestors for planting me here.
Thanks so much, Free, for your participation today.
Have a great day.
Thank you. From Lawrence, New York, Chris, you're on the air. Are you there, Mr. Chris? Okay, well, we just lost Chris. Well, here's the thing. We've gotten glimpses from all of these calls that there is an awareness that something dramatic not only has happened, but continues to happen. And it has to do with a recognition of what the system is, and more particularly, the interplay between the individual, i.e. community, and that system. In every single instance that our callers have informed us, of this consciousness, there is a dramatic role that they sense that has even been more dramatic in its deterioration in this particular cycle. And there is a consciousness that we got to do something. That's great. I like the idea of people just the same not being phased by the enormity of what seems to be the challenge on the other side of the fence. That has always been the problem. It would always be there. When you're fighting against a system, don't forget the system is a scientifically devised, living, breathing organism that has only one major job, which is to persist by every means necessary to keep everybody else in check and to survive any and all onslaughts. So when you come up against a system, naturally you are involved in long haul thinking. You have to look way down the road, but you cannot be discouraged. So this is very enlightening. The other thing that impressed me about the calls today is that these analyses that we're getting appear to be very, very simple, but they're highly complex. because people are beginning to add into the mix, not just what the system says it does, but they have a comparative analysis. This is what the system says it does, but this is what it actually does. So they know that there is a huge difference between what is professed and what the results really are. So this is great. But more than anything else, we have from all of our callers today a desire to contribute to the aggregate good. And this is where we need to start engaging and become encouraging of each other. In the small things that we set out to do, like I say, it doesn't matter what it is you set out to do. The most important thing is that everything you set out to do should have a method to it, and that method should reasonably assure the success of the thing that you want to do, which requires you to invest in making sure that you're on the right track. You've done some reading, you've done some preparation, you've done some canvassing to see whether you're in sync with the need and whether you can fulfill a need. This is great. This is where we start. And I'm so delighted today to hear from the callers that this is the purpose of radio, to create community, to encourage people to trade ideas fearlessly, to put up for consideration what they think might be helpful wherever we are. We hear from Washington, D.C., or Maryland, or Lawrence, New York, or wherever we are in one universe. We are in one planet, and we are facing a common enemy. So everything that could help us wherever we are and wherever we choose to start our work, this information is extremely helpful. And I'm always grateful that we have available to us a medium of communication that allows us to trade our ideas and our thoughts and our news and information. It helps empower us. It helps to encourage us. And Lord knows we need encouragement. And we continue. That's great. Thank you so very much for your input today. And I value your participation so much. Thank you. Keep listening. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Infectious Myth with David Crowe. And you really want to listen to that. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Always a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. I value it so much. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.